It's quite possible that when I try and speak to our first guest, something disastrous will happen. So for no other reason, keep listening for that. But I could think of no better person than to be marooned in a technical Titanic of radio with Tony Martin, who's one of Australia's best comedians and who has written, and I say this advisedly, the funniest book I've ever written. It's called, I've ever read. It's called A Nest of Occasionals. It's the second book he's written. The first was hilarious as well. And this one is, as I say, it's called A Nest of Occasionals, and it's just hilarious. It's a selection of stories from his life, but not the part of his life you would know about. Martin Malloy, radio host, you know, The Late Show, lots of other adventures in film, television and radio, but really just obscure parts of his life. And it's quite possible, I put the odds at about 60%, that when I bring up this dog, you'll be able to hear me and Tony Martin have a reasonably coherent conversation. Hello, Tony.
Hello, Tony.
Slightly like the Daleks are in the building.
Oh, you're there.
Whereas you sound like you're standing in the middle of the SCG. There's all kinds of wacky sounds going on.
It's terrible, isn't it? It is so terrible. I don't know if because you've worked in commercial radio that you've brought in some, you know, bad jujus currently in public broadcaster to infect us.
We might suddenly hear some REO Speedwagon.
Nothing could be worse than that. We might have as many Daleks as we like, but nothing as bad as REO Speedwagon. Can I ask you about your book before, you know, this disintegrates into total technical chaos? It is seriously the funniest book I've ever read. It is brilliant. Congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you, James.
So this is going to be a hard interview, obviously. When you write things, you've selected, they almost seem like random slices of your own life.
Well, sorry.
We should press on. We'll press on.
The War of the Worlds just exploded in this booth. Yes, I do. All I do is start with what's a funny thing that's happened to me, and can I remember enough about it to fashion it into a story? There's no real plan overall for it to be a book. It's just seeing the 6 inches of railway line just in front of you, and is there a funny bit anywhere there? And then at the end, you know, hopefully it'll assemble into a total book. But, there's no overall plan.
And yet it does seem, your book, these sort of, you know, random slices of life that start with something very funny, they do feel, you know, that there is a lot of craft there in the sense that, you know, you plant a seed and then five pages later it turns into a great joke. And then 10 pages later it turns into another joke. So there must have been a bit of craft there.
Well, thanks, James. There is quite a lot of work does go into it, but it's funny because I start with, there's two kinds of stories. There's one that I call the black box recording, where it's just one thing, and it happens in a fairly straightforward narrative, like in the first book where I was on a tour bus and turned everyone against me, or visiting a notary public and having a debacle happen there. Yes. But then there's other ones where it's several things over the course of a year. And those are really hard to write because you'll say, okay, what's every single thing I can remember about working at that radio station for that year? And I'll write them all down on individual cards. And that means every person I can remember, every thing that they said, every phrase I remember, every incident, every song we played. And it's just all on cards on the floor, and then you just keep whittling away till an actual story emerges, as opposed to a series of anecdotes. It's a hard thing to explain, but yeah, it's a very slow, painful process.
Is it?
It is, yeah. Well, this one took me, I mean, I don't work continuously like 9 to 5, but this was written over the course of a year and a half, and probably if you added all the work days together, it would be 10 months of continuous work.
Wow. And yeah. Tell me how you get little gems like this. This is just a wonderful expression of what it feels like to be drunk. I feel like a ventriloquist's dummy attempting to operate itself. you even laughed at it and you wrote it.
I'd forgotten that bit, sorry. No, I love any reference to ventriloquist dummy. I think there's about 3 or 4 of them in this book. I don't know. You just... you just sit there and you go, how can you, you know, how can you, I don't know how you do that. You just sit there and you try and think of the best way to describe it. That particular incident was probably the only time in my life where something has happened and I can't remember it, where I've got that Brendan Favola feeling where other people are describing things I've done, but I can't remember doing them. And it was a disgraceful incident at the 1985 Goldie Awards for excellence in radio commercials, if you can imagine such a thing. And, yeah, my behaviour was disgraceful, and it's been exaggerated over the years to the point where someone claims I punched out Billy J. Smith, the host of TV's It's a Knockout, which I did not do, nor did I set fire to Wickety Whack. But I do remember just waking up, and it's quite alarming when there's a whole blank in your memory. You may have murdered somebody during that missing period, and, yeah, just trying to describe that feeling pretty much 25 years later was pretty hard work, actually.
And there's sometimes a conflict, no doubt, between wanting to be funny and not wanting to expose everything about yourself. But luckily you've settled on the side of trying to be funny. And I refer to the very honest story you wrote about a seemingly never-ending series of medical procedures performed upon you.
Well, that's it. I mean, the intent is always to be funny. But what I like to do is to make it slightly harder for myself. So with this book, I thought, okay, can I take that same technique of getting that many jokes in and apply it to slightly more serious subjects, like a horrible weekend away on a boat when my parents are fighting, or a disastrously racist incident at an Indian restaurant that I went to. So that was the idea. Can I make these slightly more serious subjects just as funny? The medical one was just occurred because I realised that I had all five cameras that a man can have inserted into his body. And so I thought of the name first, Access All Areas. And once I had that, I was so happy with that name, I thought, now I've got to write the story.
And you're not sure about writing about your own slightly eccentric family. Did you have any qualms about how they might feel? I mean, your sister comes out of it very well, but there's other family members that might have had a bit to say.
Well, certainly with the first book, it's funny because I'll read in the paper Tony Martin's memoir of his family, and I have to point out to people it's about 8 pages out of 300 in that first book, but they seem to be the pages that people remember.
Yeah.
And with this one, I thought, well, primarily the last story where I went back to the town where I'm from, and that was in January of this year, and there was no real plan. I just thought, I'll go back to the town that I'm from, and whatever happens, that's going to be the end of the book. And, you know, it could have been a 2-page travel log, and it ended up being 11,000 words when I discovered that my grandfather wasn't the person I thought he was. But in that story, I mean, I felt quite bad writing a number of horrible things about my grandmother, but she has been dead since 1994. I mean, I would never have written any of that stuff if she was still alive.
Yeah.
But there was just such overwhelming evidence from everybody in the town that I spoke to that she was appalling,
yes.
Or she was seen as appalling, that I didn't feel like I was... I mean, to be honest, I've cut a lot of stuff out. I mean, I've tried to clean a lot of it up.
Right.
But the living people, I think of the living people in my family, I'd like to think that I come out worse than most of them. I know that there will be trouble when, I mean, there's a horrible moment where I'm posting all the copies over to New Zealand last Monday, and I know I'll be hearing from people,
yes.
But I'll report back to you.
And you must tell people what a nest of occasionals actually means.
Well, a nest of occasionals, when I was growing up, every house in the 70s at least had a nest of occasional tables, which is, can be 3, 4, or in our house, 9, tables that all snugly fit inside each other, and the smallest one pretty much only holds a coffee mug.
Yeah.
But I had to write a radio commercial where I left out the word tables in order to fit as many words as possible into a 30-second ad. So I just said a nest of occasional $79.95, and the client went nuts, called up and demanded that I be sacked or at least taken off his project. So I thought 25 years later, you know, a phrase that had caused so much trouble could now serve a useful purpose. But then in one of those nice, weird coincidences that happened, it wasn't until I decided on that name, months later, that someone pointed out what a nice phrase that is to describe our family, because there have been so many caste changes in our family that
a nest of occasionals
sort of accidentally describes the family.
They come and go. I'm talking to Tony Martin, author of a wonderfully, wonderfully funny book that's it's not a memoir, it's a slice of seemingly obscure parts of his life that he manages to make hilarious. A Nest of Occasionals. Did you often make the life you led in the book slightly funnier than the life you led in real life, just because it would make a better book?
I don't think I ever made up anything. With the dialogue from when I was a kid, you have to invent conversations, but I'm inventing them from available parts. Like, I write down phrases. There's a conversation in there about with the parents of one of my friends at school, where we had a discussion about how kids who were in the special class should be referred to. And, you know, my friend's dad was going, "Oh, mentals, can they say mentals?" And his wife's going, "Oh, we won't have that sort of language in this house." And my friend's going, "Well, we've been encouraged to say intellectually handicapped, Mum." And she's going, "I don't want to hear that phrase in this house. I prefer to call them unfortunates." Now, I remember every bit of that. You know, I've gone away and written down unfortunates, which just struck me as hilarious. But actually assembling that conversation, there is a certain amount of craft involved. Yeah. But then in the more recent ones, they're pretty much just word-for-word actual... I mean, I feel guilty writing some of them because they're just black box recordings, as I say. What it is, it's what you leave out. For example, There's a conversation in the story where I'm living in my flat in Brisbane where my mum's calling up, and this is before the internet, and somehow she knows she knows what the temperature is in Brisbane, and therefore I'm inside and you know, I'm an adult, and she's saying to me, "What are you doing inside on such a nice sunny day?" And I remember having that part of the conversation with her, and I remember her confusing the name of the film Day of the Locust. She thought it was Dave the Locust. You're watching Dave the Locust? What's Dave the Locust? So what I've done is I've just used the two funny bits of what would have been a 55-minute conversation. So it's not so much that you're inventing something, it's what you're leaving out. And so you're reducing it to just the funny bits.
Yeah, right. Did you learn how to write funny from anyone, from any other author?
Well, it was weird because I've been making a living as a writer since I was 18, and I'd never written apart from two angry letters to the Green Guide about why they weren't playing Alan Partridge on the ABC. I'd never written a single word to be read off the page until I was 40 years old and started writing Lolly Scramble. And my biggest influence was definitely Clive James, who wrote a book called Unreliable Memoirs. And I read that when I was about 17 or 18. And living in Auckland, I had no idea who Clive James was. It was just a funny name for a book, so I grabbed it from the shop. And I was amazed about that this was an Australian story. He's talking about Jaffas rolling down the aisle at the cinema and go-kart races going horribly wrong. And I kept looking at the back of the book going, am I sure this is not... This must be set in New Zealand. And that's always been an incredibly influential book for me. And two other books that are very influential would be the fiction book A Confederacy of Dunces.
Yes.
Do you know that book?
Yes.
I even though I look nothing like Ignatius J. Riley, I often feel like him. I always think of the line where he's sitting in the cinema and it says, "Ignatius scanned the credits to find the names of people whose efforts had particularly offended him in the past." And the way everything to do with Ignatius is quite influential on the way I write stuff down. And also there's a book which amateur theatre fans will know by Michael Green called The Art of Coarse Acting, where it's sort of a guide to working in the amateur theatre, but it's by someone who really knows what they're talking about. And the examples he gives are so particular. And the more particular he gets about what he's talking about, the funnier it becomes. So those three books have always been the big influence on me.
Do you find writing's hard, isn't it? You sit there in a room by yourself and you spend most of the time hating yourself for not being better or more disciplined or funnier, whereas if you're working on radio, for example, you've got a daily deadline and, you know, a sort of performance part of it every day. Do you find that difference between the two?
Radio is so much fun because you have other people you can bounce off, but writing on your own in a room, the worst part of it for me is, pardon me, is reading it back the next day and discovering that 90% of it isn't as funny as you thought it was when you were writing it. Because when I'm writing, everything I'm doing is brilliant. I'm going, this is fantastic. And then you just leave it. And I don't know if you've read that book by Stephen King called On Writing.
Yes.
And he just has, I think, the single best piece of advice for any writer, which is leave it in a drawer for 6 weeks. Leave it to the point where you can't quite remember what happens next, so that when you're reading it back, you can actually put yourself in the position of a reader who's reading it for the first time.
All right.
And all of the mistakes just immediately float to the surface, I find. But okay. it's a horrible, it's just having your face rubbed in your own inadequacies is how I would describe writing.
Even if it, that's the thing, isn't it? Even if it's good, like a lot of people have said that your first book is great. A lot of people have said this book is great. So that's the thing. I think when you're writing, probably even if it's good, you still feel like that.
Oh yeah, there's still bits. I mean, I read Lolly Scramble Back. I hadn't read it since it came out, and there's still bits in there where I'm going, oh, I could have come up with a funnier bit for that.
Yeah.
But my editor just says, leave it alone and move on. And I have a very good editor too, I should say.
I'm talking to Tony Martin. His book's called A Nest of Occasionals. It's hilarious. And Tony, what do you think? Are you happy to, you know, continue to write? Are you to write books? Do you want to work in TV and radio again? Do you feel like you've got unfinished business in those mediums?
Oh, I just have a crack at whoever won't sack me is who I'll work with. But, I mean, radio is my favourite thing to do, but you've got to have the circumstances have to be exactly right. You have, especially for the kind of radio I do, which is very high production and a lot of sound effects and bells and whistles, and you've got to have the right person to bounce off. And I had, the last project I did, I had Ed Cavalli and the late Richard Marsden, and that was just such a great team. It was just so much fun to go into work every day. But, you know, writing, after that ended so badly, the great thing about writing a book is I'm going, well, the only person who can sack me off this project is me. So,
yeah.
But I would like to continue writing books. The thing is, even Lolly Scramble was not, it's in its fourth printing, but it's never been a massive success. I think I've made $25,000 off that book. So it's not something you can really make
that
a living.
Would be, but in terms of Australian publishing, that would be a substantial success.
Oh, I've had people tell me that's like I'm like Dan Brown in the eyes of some people.
Yes.
But it's not something you can really make a living from, I don't think.
Yeah.
So what I do is I'll go and do radio and they'll pay me some good money and that will buy me the time to take a year off and write a book. So,
you've got another
movie.
Have you got another movie in you?
I would like to make another film. I mean, I made one which had good things about it and there were bad things about it. And the bad things were all mine, by the way. I'm not criticising anyone who worked on it. But I think I then did a second film, which you may have read about, which never came out, which was a largely improvised film. And I think on that project I learnt how to direct actors and how to work with actors and how to include improvisation in the process. So I would love to now take all that technique that I've learnt and go back and do a more straightforward narrative film, but they cost so much money and they take so long to get off the ground. It's, you know, I'd like to think of a faster way to make a film, like a sort of a more dogma approach, as it
were. Well, there's huge, you couldn't get a greater contrast, could you, between writing, where you can be very arduous, but basically there's no technical impediments as long as you own either a computer or a pen.
That's
and
right.
And making a film where there's enormous technical impediments and an enormous amount of other people who have to say yes before you can actually do anything.
Oh, there's so many. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to capture human behaviour that even in a contrived comedy script has to appear naturalistic in some way. And to make naturalistic behaviour occur on a film set, which is the most ridiculously artificial, contrived circumstance you can ever imagine, that's the trick of it. And, I mean, the people I love who make films, the films that I like, are people like Robert Altman, who can capture this sort of documentary-style behaviour against incredible odds of making a film.
Mm. Do you ever think it's not fair? You know, do you ever think I've always been good on the radio, that I did some good work on telly, that I've written these two wonderful books, and I might be unemployed next year. I don't know what's going to happen.
Well, it's everyone I know. I know some very people who are way more successful than me, and they're always panicking about where the next job's coming from. That goes on all the time. I guess, I don't know, I mean, it's, with radio, I've always, the thing I've had is that all the shows I've done, even the last one that got axed, have actually been successful in the ratings. So that's given me, you know, that's allowed me to take a few years off and go and do more obscure work and come back to radio each time. But I never have any confidence. I never feel like I've reached the top of any kind of mountain.
Well, that's probably good in a way.
I think it is. Imagine how up yourself you would be if you thought everything. I mean, I do know some comedians who think that everything they do is great. And you don't, when you get to that point, I don't think you have any perspective. You don't have any ability to recognise what you do, which parts of what you're doing are rubbish. Because, yeah, as I was saying earlier, it's 90% of what you write is terrible, and the art is recognising which are the good bits and which are the bits you should throw away.
Yeah, right. Well, look, I'm sorry about the slightly surreal start to this interview, but thank you very much for bearing with us and even, you know, trying to salvage the wreckage by doing some sort of Dalek impression. That was excellent.
No, thanks, James. I hope it's... Is everything plugged in? Is everything patched in where it should be?
It is at the moment. What will happen at 5 past 7 after the news is another adventure that we will tackle then. But the book is called A Nest of Occasionals by Tony Martin. I don't say this lightly. I seek out funny books. This is the funniest book I have ever read. I was crying. So well done, and I hope you write another one soon.
That's a big compliment, and I have to thank you for all your support of the first one, Lolly Scramble, James, because I know a lot of people who bought it because they heard you raving about it on the radio, so thanks very much.
Oh, well, I'll look forward to the check. See you, mate.
When I get one, I'll pass it on to you.
Thank you very
Cheers.
Much. That's Tony Martin. We will be back after the news, technical gods willing.